It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 86.
Stealing swords from lords and monsters just to make a living.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
We have with us today Michael Sullivan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
We should have checked this actually before we started, but how do you say, is it Riria?
It's pronounced, I pronounce it Riira. However, it's also, some people pronounce it Riria. Either one are pretty okay with me, but I personally would do it Riira.
Riira. Okay. That way we can say that correctly from now on. So you're the author of Riira, right?
Riira Revelations.
Riira Revelations.
Just let me do all the talking for that.
Which has recently gone to Orbit and has now been turned into, from five books now into three. Which
It was originally six books, and they've turned it into three, putting two in each volume.
Okay, six books, excuse me. Which is awesome, actually really awesome, because you are a self-published author.
Originally, I started out being published by a small independent press out of Minnesota, and that they did the first book, and they started to do the second one, but they ran out of money. They had it all edited and all set to go, but they ran out of cash to put the printing done, and as a result, I took it over because we had a very short deadline. It was supposed to be done in April, and we had lots of things lined up for that. We had podcasts, we had book clubs, we had reviewers standing by for it, and we just didn't have any kind of, we needed to have it out right away, and we couldn't have taken it to a big publisher at that moment due to the fact that, they would take 6 months to a year probably to get it out, and we needed to have it out quicker. Because the first one to come out, we had promised it, and I didn't want to break that promise. It ended up breaking it on the last book, but initially that's where we started. And then once I started self-publishing it, I just kept going for the next five books.
Fantastic. So sort of an intro question, what kind of drew you into writing, and why fantasy in particular?
Well, I never really intended to write fantasy as a publishing work. I started writing fantasy in high school because I had read The Lord of the Rings, and I couldn't find anything else to write or to read after that. So I started thinking, what else, where else can I get something to read? So I started writing, and I started writing fantasy novels as a kid, and I just started writing, three or four of them at school. And I did that until about 18 years old, and I stopped writing fantasy. I stopped reading fantasy. And as a result, I actually got involved in books like Stephen King and Dune, and I got into science fiction and that sort of thing. But I never really intended to write fantasy until I quit writing completely. I realized I wasn't going to get published. I had done it for 10 years and not gotten anywhere, so I completely quit. And then I started to I started an advertising agency, and I worked at that for quite some time, about 12 years. And then I just wanted to write a fun book. I read Harry Potter, and that reminded me of the early days when I had read Tolkien, and I had read Watership Down and all the fun books. So I wanted to write that kind of a book. And I was doing it for my daughter, because my daughter was dyslexic and she was having trouble in school. So I thought I would try and write something that was fun and enjoyable for her. And I just started writing fantasy for the primary reason that it was going to be fun and easy, and I didn't have to do a lot of research on it. I could just make up whatever I wanted and just make a fun story. And it just turned out that that was the one that got published.
I want to go back real quick. You indicated that Watership Down is in your selection of fun books.
Yeah. So,
I don't know if I would consider that book terribly fun.
Why was that?
I mean, I love the book. The book is amazing, but I don't think I've ever thought of rabbits the same way after that book.
it reminded me of a great adventure story. I liked the characters. I liked the fact, you know, how the main character, Fiverr and Hazel were the kind of the weaker characters, but they ended up, leading this band on this very, you know, dangerous and treacherous trip, and it ended up well. And that was the kind of story that I liked. It was similar, the most similar book I think I found to the Tolkien, in fact.
Yeah, but I would agree. I mean, it's a very well thought out, almost to the same extent that Tolkien, with this sort of fully realized world. I mean, Adams went to great lengths, I mean, to give us this picture of rabbits as if they were really rabbits. Not just like anthropomorphized, you know, they walk around carrying swords.
Right, yes.
They're actual rabbits. Another one you might like, have you ever read Duncton Wood by William Horwood?
I did. I read that when it came out.
Oh, okay. I love that one too.
read neither, so
okay. Well,
like
you
schmuck now.
You've got to read Duncton Wood because it's it is fantastic. My mom made me read it, and I've never looked back from that. I love it. So okay, so one of the questions that Jen came up with, but she stole it from me because
I did.
I'm sure you're well aware, but there was recent controversy over a review. We won't go into the actual review, but just in general, sort of talking about reviews. I'm sure, you know, you've gone through very different processes for publishing, which, you know, if, even with self-publishing and traditional publishing, there's lots of, like, blowback, you know, people fighting over what's the right way. And I'm sure reviews have come your way before that have not been terribly nice. So do you take this personally, or is there, like, do you have this, you know, like, do you meditate and it does, or you just not read them at all?
I read them some of the times, but I really don't spend a lot of time thinking about them. My opinion's always been that everyone's entitled to their own opinion, and you know, I don't make comments about reviews whether they're good or bad. I try to never, you know, make a comment on any of those, because you can never make a good comment to a bad review except to say thank you for reviewing my book, and you know, I'm sorry I didn't like it. But in the case of even good reviews, I don't make comments there, because if you make comments to a good review, then by omission, you're kind of like saying something about the bad reviews. Also, if you establish a rapport with a reviewer, then you have a situation where that reviewer, it's almost like you're hurting their integrity. Like, oh, well, you know, he's saying that this is a good book because of the fact that, you know, they're friends or something. So I tend to try to, you know, keep a distance from any reviewers. But as far as my personal reaction to reviews, it's unpleasant. It was unpleasant more originally. When I first published, the very first review I had, which wasn't a professional one, it was a personal one where I sent it an electronic version. I got a person's response from it who I didn't know. And they tore it apart, and I was just devastated. And that was really bad. But then over the years of having the books out there, they've now been out there about 3 years, I've had, I don't know how many, probably 1,000 reviews of the books done, and so many of them have been positive that you get this kind of buffer to where if one person says they really despise this book, it's the worst book ever, it really doesn't bother you because you've got 1,000 other people who said they love it. So it tends to soften the blow to some extent. But usually I'll read a review, and if it's you know, really trashing me, then I won't finish it, and I'll just move on, and I don't really spend much time with it.
Do you learn
anything from the reviews? Do you take any of what they say to heart in terms of, you know, how you might write a future book or whatnot? Do you think that you learn anything from them, even when they're, you know, good? Even good reviews will, you know, occasionally at least say something bad or about the book.
Well, I'd say critical, not bad.
critical, not bad. Wrong choice of words. So do you think you learn from them at all?
Well, actually, there was one review, I think it was about a year ago on Amazon, where a person pretty much trashed the book. I mean, he really disliked it, and he went off on it, and it launched sort of a comment war And I actually contacted that person by email, and I asked them for specifics because he had complained about some, you know, I think he had complained about that the editing was bad. So I asked him for specifics, you know, because it was an ebook and I can actually change it. So right. if there were mistakes, I'll fix the mistakes. And he came back and it turned out that there was like three mistakes that he found. And I was like, this is what you were complaining about? But he also had some really good ideas insofar as other aspects of the book. And they were minor, but I did actually make the changes. And I let him know that I made the changes. And he turned around, he changed his review of the book based off of that. And we've been in very good terms ever since that. So yeah, I have changed, and this is an interesting thing, is that when I went to Orbit, when their editor went through and edited the books, they had a number of suggestions. Now, as an author, my first time with a traditional publisher, I'm concerned what they're going to do with it, because I had worked on this for 5 years, or even longer, really, and it had become like my pride and joy, and I didn't want them tearing it apart, and I had heard all these stories about how editors will just tear apart your book. And so I was very concerned. So when they came back with the editing, I looked at it and had all these suggestions like, oh, my God, they want me to change all these things. As it turned out, they didn't. These were just things that I could think about if I wanted to change them or not. They didn't even expect me to do them. So I said, okay, well, that's great to know. And then what I had was a list of potential changes that I had obtained through, like I said, 2 years of people writing reviews and saying what they liked and what they didn't. And there were some that I went, you know, doggone it, you're absolutely right. One person had complained about the fact that I used the term bulleted helm, as in the bullet shape of a helm. Well, there are no bullets. And I'm like, yes, you're absolutely right. That's true. And there were some other changes throughout the book that people had just found small inconsistencies or things that just really bothered them. There was a scene with Myron in the first book, which a lot of people had problems with. Some people didn't. It was something of controversy. But after hearing about it, I did have to admit that I did agree with them. So there were a number of changes that I wanted to make based off of that. But the other interesting thing with that was that when the editor went ahead and had suggestions that they wanted to put in, or, you know, they weren't pressuring me for it, but they just said, you know, we think this might help the book out. I was very confident in being able to say, no, that's not a good idea, because I know what my audience liked, and I knew how many people liked that and how many people didn't like that. So having it out there and having self-published allowed me to know how I should change that book to make it as good as it could be.
It gave you sort of a different way to get into the mind of your viewers, as it were.
Yeah, it was sort of like a marketing test. You know, you can send it out there first and see what the focus group said first.
Do you think are you the kind of person who holds to that self-publishing is sort of an end-all, like that everybody, because there are some that are saying everybody should just self-publish, and then there are others saying no, never self-publish, and then there are those in the middle. Which do you fall under?
Well, I've independently published, I've self-published, and I've traditionally published. So I pretty much have been on every side of this argument. In my opinion, would be that it all depends on what you're looking for. And what you're looking for may change over time. If you're looking to have sort of the recognition, like you have this dream, you want to be on every bookshelf in the country. If you have this dream of being a traditional publisher or a traditionally published author, then yeah, you're going to want to go for that. You're not necessarily going to want to be self-published. And in some instances, you want to struggle and probably work on that, because you're not going to be happy with anything less than it. If, on the other hand, I know many people who are actually getting older in years, and they don't have time to get an agent and go through the several-year process that, even if their book was pristinely perfect, they would take several years to get anywhere. So they for them, they're not looking for necessarily the celebrity recognition or the self-fulfilling prestige so much as they're looking for just making some money and having a source of income as they go into their retirement age. And so for them, it really doesn't matter if they're traditionally published. So it has no bearing on it whatsoever. And then there's other people who, you know, they're somewhere in the middle. They don't want to have to go through all the effort that you would if you're self-publishing, as far as self-promoting and going through the editing process and the cover art and the layout. So they're willing to kind of stand in the middle and have an independent publisher handle that for them, and yet they still get some control, more than they might with a traditional publisher. So it really, I feel, it depends on what you want and where you are in your career. Now, for me, I started off wanting to get into traditional publishing, but couldn't. So I was left with no other choice. And then I got the independent deal. I was like, okay, that's great. And then, of course, that fell through, so I had to self-publish. So I didn't really intend to do that, is where I ended up. But then when I got the choice of going to traditional, I realized that that's what I wanted to do for the next stage of my career, because the first stage had been I had become an economic success. I was making good money, and I knew I could continue to do that. But the traditional was going to open new doors and allow more people to find out who I am, and in that way, I would be expanding my fan base to the point where I would hopefully be able to do even better. But that was really the main gist of why I did what I did. But I think it really depends on what people want and what they're looking for.
So economically, do you think that you're doing better now that you're traditionally published? Or if you, kind of divorce the fact that you're getting a larger fan base from it, which, can increase, the economic benefits of self-publishing. But if you just were to take the two separately, which one have you been better off under?
Financially, I was much more better off self-published.
I suspected that would be your answer.
Yeah, I was making an enormous amount of money self-publishing, and I actually took what I expected to be my future earnings, and I considered that to be an investment that I was going to be putting back into my career, such as if you had a business. And your first year you make a profit, you take that money and you put it back into the business in order to build it. And that's exactly what I was doing. I was taking the potential money I would have made over the course of these next few years off of the series, and I'm taking that and I'm putting it back into my career, investing it in such a way that I'm now going to expand the number of people who will be reading me. So in future, hopefully that will grow. Also, there's a potentiality, and this is really completely crazy, but as a writer, first-time writer, I wanted to roll the dice, because I didn't really think I would ever become huge if I self-published. But there was at least the chance that if I got traditionally published, that who knows, lightning could strike and I could actually have a mainstream following. And so I thought, for once, I'm going to take that shot, because I figured this was a great time to do it. I had a following already for these books. I'm first time publishing with a traditional publisher. Those two things combined, and the book's coming out just before Christmas. I figured this is my big shot to make some sort of best-selling list. So I figured that was worth taking the chance.
And it's not like you technically lose anything. I mean, if it doesn't work out and they don't publish any future books, you can go back to your original fan base and go where you were before.
Yeah, I strongly suspect that if I never gained another reader beyond what I already have, but if the readers, and even only if half the readers who have read my books so far continue to buy my future books, I would be economically sound.
Whew. Okay, that's good.
Well, the difference is when you self-publish, you get you get 100% of the profits. I mean, despite what you give to Amazon or to Barnes & Noble. So you get so much more. You don't have to sell nearly as much. And unlike some of the other self-published authors, I never sold my books, briefly as a sales tool, but I never sold them at 99 cents or $2.99. They were always around, $4.99, $5.99, and I think the last one was at $6.99. So I was selling at a fairly high price point, and I never had any trouble selling them, and I never had anyone complain about the price of the books. So that being the case, and the fact that I wasn't having to, give most of that money away to distributors and so on and so forth, that made it possible for me to actually live off my income, because most writers don't.
So, okay, why don't we, because this is really fascinating, I think, to talk about the differences between self-publishing and the tracks that we take. But we also really want to talk about your book. And in particular, Jen had a question about heroes, and particularly about Hadrian and Royce.
Well, this is kind of a combination question for the two of us, because obviously Hadrian and Royce, they're not your typical heroes. They're your everybody's favorite anti-heroes. They're not good. They're not bad. They're just thieves, at least in the beginning. What made you choose to decide to focus on this type of character?
Well, initially, it just was an idea that I thought. I started off coming up with the idea because I was actually thinking of a television series. I had just seen Babylon 5, and I was struck by the concept that the creator of it had written the entire 5-year series prior to doing the pilot, I think. And that was just amazing because as you watch that show, you can see that story threads appear in the very beginning that are touched down somewhere in the middle and then come back in the end. And I thought that was a fascinating way to do a story. And I thought, you know, if you were going to do another television series, it would be great to have that same idea where you have a mystery that's taking place in the overall, you know, like episode, and then you have the season-long mystery or stories that's going on there, and then you have the entire series arc. And I thought that would be great to do insofar as a television series. But I thought the one thing they didn't do was, and I haven't seen this done, maybe I'm wrong, but I've never noticed it, is a fantasy television series that was successful. They always seemed, you know, kind of either campy when they did do them, or they're very stiff and, you know, haughty, and they're like, oh my lord, I will go off and do this for you. And it just seemed to me that those were just not very well done. And I wanted to have just a typical, relaxed, common language, fun, a little bit of humor, almost like a Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where there's serious and scary moments, and there's also fun, lighthearted moments. And I thought, you know, I was going to do a fantasy story, and this one idea just popped into my head one day, which is two thieves are climbing this tower to steal a sword, and when they get in there, they discover the dead body of the king and realize they've been set up for this crime. And that, I thought, was a great quick launching point that would drag, you know, a reader or a viewer into the story, and suddenly it just takes off from there. So it's sort of like a thriller setup for a fantasy story. And of course, I'm not a television producer. I realized I could never do that, but then it hit me, well, I could write it. And this is where I got the first idea. Then I was walking around for weeks thinking about this, and actually years technically. And finally I went, well, I could write it, and each book could actually be like a season of a television series. So it would be a complete story. But the entire story is the entire 6-book series. And that's kind of how I went about doing that. But the anti-hero thing, I liked the idea of Royce being this vicious killer, and you could almost see it like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, if you're familiar with that show or that movie, that you have one guy who's kind of cold and calculating, the other guy who's much more personable and is actually a nice person. And as I played with that idea, I realized it would be really fun to play the two off of each other. So you have one dark, one light. You have one who is pragmatic, you have one who is, you know, has empathy toward everyone around him, and the kind of dialogue they would have back and forth, because while deep down these two love each other to a point where they would die for each other, but at the same time they're almost exact opposites, and that causes for such interesting viewpoints on every problem and allows them to have interesting conversations and tension. But it's done with humor, so you don't really feel these people hate each other. And I've always liked characters who are happy with each other, so that you have, as a reader, you really like them, you're comfortable with them, and that these are the kind of people that you want to spend time with. Because I think that's key for anything, for a movie or a book. And all the great books that I've always loved were the ones where they had characters that I loved, characters that I wanted to have as personal friends of mine. I mean, I would have loved to have known the characters from The Lord of the Rings, or even the rabbits from Watership Down, or the Harry Potter characters. I mean, those were fun people. Those were nice people. I liked them. I wanted to spend time with them. And that's what I was aiming for with these two characters.
No, I just want to say I would not hang out with Royce and Hadrian, not because they're not interesting guys, but because they have a tendency to get in trouble, and I like my head. I don't want to lose it.
I mean, that's kind of the thing about them is, yeah, they're fun, they're interesting, they're cool to hang out with until they're getting you in trouble or making you lose your head, but they're still, you know, at the core, well, maybe not at the core, but from... in the beginning, at least, they're the bad guys of a typical story. Hadrian quickly, you know, he does it because he wants to do the right thing and everything, but
I don't see them as bad guys. I see them as neutral.
They're thieves. They're neutral at best.
Like that, because the bad guys really in this are, you know, it's the quote unquote good and the bad guys are really in the nobility. You know, it's the people that are either trying to upset the system or people that are, they don't care either way. They'll steal from anybody.
Well, actually, how I designed them, and it states this in the very beginning of The Theft of Swords, where Albert is discriminating between the different types of thieves, where there is your what you consider evil thief, which is the one who either picks your pocket or kidnaps people on the road and ransoms them or you know, will kill you. Royce and Hadrian actually they're called thieves, but in actuality, in context of the story, they're actually more like secret agents, because they're hired by one nation or one head of state to take on a mission that's usually a diplomatic mission of stealing something for the purpose of embarrassing another head of state or for saving someone from embarrassment. Or in rare cases, you know, stealing something. So they're more like James Bond than they are like, say, I can't even think of a famous evil thief or killer. But so they're really not portrayed in the fashion of, say, Mark Lawrence's or John Sprunk's thieves or assassins. They're not people who have no morals. Royce doesn't have a lot of morals, but Hadrian has a lot of morals to make up for that. But they're really not what you consider to be bad or evil characters, because, as you'll notice, they never really do anything bad or evil in the story, because they're so they're just taking special missions rather than actually surviving by stealing.
Like I said, Jen, they're not the bad guys.
I know they're not the bad guys. And I've read even further than that, than you, so I know they're definitely not the bad guys.
Yeah,
when it comes right down to it.
I did really, I really liked Hadrian and Royce a lot. I thought they were just so much fun to read, which is good, because they are the primary characters. So if they weren't fun to read, I suppose the book wouldn't be fun to read. but they were. And I'm very curious though, because they are kind of, I mean, I guess in a one way, anti-heroes, as Jen was saying. But yet, because they are central characters, and yet Jen and I both really enjoyed reading them, and I'm sure a lot of your fans have enjoyed reading these two characters, why do you think that there are so many ruffians, like, lately in fantasy that people just love reading about? You know, ruffians and antiheroes and people that are not necessarily bad guys, but not really the good guys, are kind of in the middle. I mean, what is it, do you think, that compels people towards these characters, that makes us love them so much?
I'm not sure that anyone loves these characters. I think they like reading about them. But I actually liken this a bit to the late 60s, early 70s in the film industry, where all throughout the 60s and 50s, you had these westerns and you had musicals and you had all these happy, good hero types that were dominating the movies and television industry. But in the late 60s, you had movies that broke that mold. You had movies like Easy Rider. You had movies like Midnight Cowboy. And there was about drugs and gangsters. You had, you know, The Godfather, where you had the anti-heroes like Clint Eastwood and his spaghetti westerns. So this became very popular because I think people felt it was more real, more realistic than the traditional hero type of stories that were kind of coming out of Hollywood for the last few decades. So I think I think because of the Vietnam War as well, people were looking for something that was more relatable to what they were experiencing in real life. And I think that's the same kind of thing that's happening in fantasy now, with people who are tired of the hero concept of the Lord of the Rings that had been redone over and over again. And then, of course, you know, so now they're embracing this dark and gritty new era. And I can see why they would do it, because, you know, they're just tired of the oversaturation of the old stories, which they don't feel they can relate to. They want something that is much more realistic. So I actually, when I was growing up in the 70s, I hated movies because I never really got a chance to see the hero stuff. And so when I was watching, all the movies I had were always depressing, and the heroes always lost in the end. I mean, you had movies like The Omen, where everyone gets killed and, you know, the devil wins. And it's just, that was what I was growing up with. So I hated those films. And then one day in 1977, I went and saw Star Wars, and I was like, wow, that's a movie. And I said to myself, you know, that's, you know, what I really enjoyed. So in a way, I guess I was kind of writing this the Star Wars story here because I can tell I'm completely surrounded on all sides by the Martin Scorsese's and Robert De Palma's, and they're the ones who are making these dark and gritty stories and getting great acclaim for it, and of course many of them are extremely good. But what I wanted was that kind of happy, enjoyable film like the Star Wars or the Indiana Jones, which, believe it or not, are filled with cliches and they're throwbacks to the old Hollywood days, which is exactly what my book is. It's filled with some of the old cliches and it's the throwback to the old days, but hopefully in a way that's a little bit different, a little bit fresher than some of the other ones have been done.
I think sometimes you're right. You know, you look at something like Star Wars or Indiana Jones, and both are in their own way. I think Indiana Jones maybe a little bit more kind of pokes a little bit of fun at some of the old sort of adventure films than maybe Star Wars does it. But it is sort of like the mark of a good story that can play on the cliches is perhaps that it can kind of poke fun at those cliches.
Yeah, there's actually a couple of things that people have picked up on. I tend to put little Easter eggs in my stories and see if anyone notices. And there's actually one moment in the beginning of Crown where I actually have them at a wall, a sheer cliff wall that's supposed to be leading inside to an underground dwelling, sort of like Moria in Lord of the Rings. And I assumed anyone seeing this or reading this would immediately think, oh, my God, he's doing Tolkien at Moria. So, of course, I had to acknowledge that. So I actually have a line in there of something along the lines of, everyone knows you can't speak a word and have it open.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. I did.
Which is sort of an homage to me to Tolkien, because he's one of my favorite writers. But the fact of the matter is I just had to say, yes, I understand that this is like that, but it's not really.
Yeah, and I did really find that scene very fascinating because, you know, the moment you get there and they're standing there and they can't figure out, and Royce is kind of doing his quote-unquote Gandalf moment where he's, like, grumbling about he can't get it open. But yet you realize, like, you know, there is no magic word, that this isn't magic per se. This is, like, really complex dwarf, like, stonework. And then once you get inside, which I'm not going to ruin, there's stuff on the inside that is freaky.
Yeah, it's not exactly Moria.
Yeah, no, Moria is kind of pretty, like it's falling apart, but pretty.
Yeah.
And this is like, I wouldn't go there for like, you know, summer vacation. Like, it's not going to happen. But I don't want to ruin it because I want people to actually read it and I want them to see and all that. But I did, like, yeah, I saw that too and I was like, that, I was glad that it didn't go totally Tolkien, you know, and have them use a word, but you actually did something a little bit more clever, and then made the inside not, yeah. And I'll have a question about dwarfs later, but
okay,
because
So I had a question that it was a question at one point, and it might turn into a question as I start talking. But it occurred to me while you were talking about, you know, that they're the kind of hired guns sort of characters. But one of the things that I found really nice about having such conflicted heroes as the main characters is that other characters that, you know, seem kind of mundane in comparison, like Thrace and Theron in Avanpartha, is that they actually seemed more heroic in comparison for the actions that they were taking in, you know, without the tools that Hadrian and Royce have. And conversely, your bad guys, the seem even more despicable because, you know, there's nothing really redeeming about them. Did you set out to, going back to, you know, like Thrace and Theron, did you set out to create heroes of the common man and woman, or was that kind of just a happenstance of the world you created?
Well, whenever I write a character, I always endeavor to find what their motivation is, and because that's kind of how they move. That's how you can determine where they're going to do and what they're going to do. Without that, you have no idea. So I have to figure out what they want, what their goal is, and somehow, I don't know what it is, but when I'm writing a character, I always find something noble about that character, something redeeming, even in the form of Saldr, who you would think of as an evil character. Because he's one of the main antagonists of the story. But even in his own mind, he is a hero. He is trying to save the world. And you'll find as you get further in the series, he does even more and more along those lines. He just goes about it in kind of the wrong ways. So I try to make everyone at least a hero in their own mind. And yes, as far as Theron and Thrace, I mean, she needed to be a certain type of character because she plays a larger role down the road here. So she needed to show some degree of courage and a tenacity. And both of those characters are, I believe I actually describe them as being like granite, and that you never want to be the object in the way of that plow, because they will tear you up if they have a reason. So this is established early on in Avanpartha. That's how you pronounce it, by the way. And so as you go further in the story, that has a real meaning, because how I define those two characters in particular applies much later on in the story, and you'll understand why those characters were defined that way, as strong, courageous. But also, you notice from Theron, he tends to lose his desire to live because he has no reason to, or at least he thinks he has no reason to. But when that's restored, then you see the strength of this individual, this person who's like from, you know, the ground of the earth, and he's just this natural force. That's very different than Royce and Hadrian, who are much more sophisticated, but he's just this, you know, bedrock that, you know, he doesn't have their talent, but he's just this all heart type of person, and he has all grit. And that's what those characters were designed to be.
I do like that you said that about your antagonist in their own mind must believe that they are doing good work, that they're doing something that is heroic in their own minds. Because I think that sometimes with a lot of fantasy, you get sort of like where the bad guy is just, he's just pure evil. He just wants to destroy the world and submit it to his dominion. You know, you think like Lord of the Rings, which is great, and it's really beautiful and everything, but yet Sauron, for the most part, is pretty much, he just wants power. He just wants to take over everything. But that's not really how, like, in most cases, evil people work. Like, evil people think that they're doing a good work, even if other people disagree with them. I mean, you just think about the evil people in our own world. I mean, all these major evil figures, in their own head, they were doing a great service to mankind. That it may be a skewed version of mankind, but still. So I did appreciate that too about your antagonists and your supposed bad guys. That in fact that they're not just bad for the sake of bad. They're bad because they're doing something that it goes against the characters we want, we believe in, that whose mission we agree with. So if that made any sense.
Yeah, actually, there's a couple of themes that run through this book, which I won't get into because to explain them would give you hints of what's going to come. But there are two different themes in the story, and one of them, which I can give you a little hint at, is that it's the concept of duality, which is how people perceive the world. And you'll notice that in Avanpartha, when they talk about the glass half empty and the glass half full, it's Royce and Hadrian are this kind of yin and yang, but that extends to the entire story to some extent. Is, like you said, people who are bad don't think they're bad. I mean, to every person who you think is evil, there's someone in the world who thinks they're great. And so when you realize that, you realize there's really the question of, is there good and evil? And that's kind of a concept which I play with a little bit in the story as you go further through it.
Jen, is your next question? Is that your next question?
No, next question, but we can skip that question.
No, actually, it was kind of answered. Well, he did talk about that. You did talk about the dialogue between Hadrian and Royce. That was actually my next question. Because I found that the way that their dialogue went back and forth was, it was very, like, it flowed really well between them, and it felt like they were two characters that had been working together for a while.
That was intended.
But I was curious whether you found writing Hadrian and Royce particularly easy, writing their dialogue in particular, or if maybe they were harder because they seemed so close together.
Yes. They were extremely easy. I didn't even realize I was doing anything particularly good until people started reading it and saying, "Oh, I love the banter." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" I had no idea what anyone was mentioning. I thought that was just how people talked. I mean, that's how I talk with people. That's how I would get along with my friends. So I just thought this is normal. This is just normal conversation. As opposed to, like I was saying earlier, I didn't like the style of writing, particularly in fantasy, where people tried to recreate sort of an archaic sound. Most fantasy novels do that. They don't use common language. They use very sophisticated language that they imagine people back in the medieval times used. And I just felt that that caused a barrier between the reader and the story and what was actually happening, because you had to kind of decipher what was being said, and then you could apply it to the story, where I wanted to keep it simple. And if you actually lived in that period, that's the kind of language you would hear. You would hear the word okay. You would hear the word, words that you would normally – you wouldn't hear words like Chaucer would use. If you were back then, they wouldn't seem strange to you. They wouldn't seem unusual. They'd seem very normal, and you'd get all the jokes. If I were to actually write with the language that would have been used during that time, you wouldn't be able to read it, because I'd be writing in Middle English, and most people couldn't even follow that. So I was trying to come up with something that was so casual, as if you were actually living in that period, as opposed to some other writers who actually try and make it alien for the purpose of making you think this is an alien world that you're visiting. I mean, both are perfectly legitimate as far as I'm concerned, but what I was trying to do was write a very complex plot with a lot of hints and mysteries, so I didn't want you to have to struggle with the language. But what I was actually drawing that from, I found out later, I didn't even realize this when I did it, but when I was creating Royce and Hadrian, I just wrote off the top of my head, and like I said, I wasn't trying to do anything special. But later, I was watching some old episodes of a television series called I Spy, which was out in the mid-60s with Bill Cosby and Robert Culp, and I had loved it as a kid. But it wasn't until I was watching some old reruns, I went, my God, it's practically Royce and Hadrian. And I looked them up and on the internet, and a number of reviews of that show had all said the same thing, which was they loved the banter between the two characters. And I found that strange, because it's the exact same word they use in describing Royce and Hadrian. I went, wow. And so I had kind of subconsciously taken it from there, and subconsciously taken it from Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, which apparently stayed in my head, and I had no idea I was doing it. But now when I go back and look at those things, I can see the source or the impetus of a lot of the ideas I had come up with.
That explains Ezra Haddon so nicely, and his, you know, initial kind of archaic language and then turning into a much more free-flowing common language.
And he has a fit about it. He's like,
yes,
you guys speak like idiot. I mean, he doesn't say that exactly, but essentially he's implying, you know, you speak like low-level farmer losers. Like, you're talking ridiculously. Where is your appropriate language? And I did find that kind of amusing. You know, he's talking in this funny way, and they're all looking at him like, what the hell's wrong with you?
Yeah, that was just the situation where I knew I had to do that, because if he was from that long ago, he wouldn't have the same language type. So in that concept, if you have a character that goes back in time, you'd have to acknowledge that the language is going to be different. Or if you have a character that goes forward in time, you'd expect to be a language different. But if you're in the same time period, there shouldn't be, you know, a strange dialect that's hitting the reader.
Yeah.
So you kind of touched on the fact that, you know, you wanted the sort of relationship between the two of them to be simple, because you were setting up a fairly complicated backstory, and you've definitely done that. There's a lot of intrigue, the mysterious motivations, a lot of political history. And in fact, if I had any complaint about the book at all, is that there's so much of it that at times it comes, you know, a little bit too much. Did you feel a need to explain that much about the world, just to give people, your readers, a more solid footing in it? Or was it just to set up, you know, future actions?
That's kind of interesting. And it goes to perception, because of the fact that I've had so many people read my book and say I have not nearly enough world building involved in here. They want to know much more about the politics. They want to know much more about the religions and the rest of the world. And I actually, people who are more versed and veterans in the realm of fantasy found this to be exceedingly light, exceedingly simple, and they really needed more depth. And when they read the Crown Conspiracy, they come away thinking this is a very, you know, simple, silly little tale, and it has no depth. Then they read Avanparth and they go, oh, okay, well, you've got a little bit more information coming at me. I'm starting to see that you've done some work in this. You're not just, you know, writing about two, you know, simple characters in a nondescript world. So it's funny that you should say that, because I hear that from both sides. I hear one people say that you put too much in, and one person say you don't. Particularly in a later book where you're on a ship, I've done research, and they say, well, you put too much jargon in there for ships, and then other people say you didn't put enough. So it's strange that way. But what I was trying to do when I was writing the series. What I don't like in personally, and when I'm reading a fantasy novel, is I don't like the wall of information that you usually get when you open a book and you just start reading about a race or a particular portion of the world, and they'll have all these unusual and hard to pronounce names, and they go on for a very long period of time, and you don't even know who the main character is or what the season is or what's happening. They're just telling you, in the year of the reign of so-and-so, at the time of the great flood, when the, you know, and it's just going on. I'm like, I don't care about any of this because I don't even understand what you're telling me, and I'm going to forget it. I need to know who I am, where I am, and what's going on. So when I wrote The Crown Conspiracy, I wanted it to be quickly establishing who the characters are and what's happening and getting you involved in a story. And I wanted you to get to be interested in maybe what is about the rest of the world. And once you're connected to the characters and you're involved in a story, you get much more willing to read those longer passages that give you some background. And it's not a matter of just, I invented this, so I need to tell you about it, because I actually wrote about 8,000 years worth of history for this world, and you touched the very thinnest slice of the top of that iceberg. Because I don't believe in putting in a bunch of unnecessary information that I have as backstory that I use for my own reference, but it doesn't apply to the story. If it doesn't apply to the story, it's not in the book. Almost everything that you see in that book, if I give it to you as information, you're going to need it at some point. And what my technique was is I gave you just a brief reference. Like you'll notice in Crown Conspiracy, I tell you a little bit about the gods. Then Myron gives you a quick description of them. And then I don't talk about them again. And you don't need to know about them. Then in Avanpartha, I give you another little bit of information about them. And I keep feeding you bits of information over and over at different ways, so it doesn't seem so repetitive. But when you finally do need to know that information, you won't even realize you've learned it. And you'll go, oh, I know what that means now. So I was trying to make it so that it wasn't this huge wall of information that you felt you had to take notes in. So I tried to feed it out slowly so that it wasn't so off-putting. But apparently in your case, I failed.
That's okay. It was only a couple of times where I was like, all right, that's a lot. What's happening next? Because I wanted to, you know, keep on with just the story part of it, the action and the banter, which was a lot of fun to read. So,
yeah, unfortunately, with a book of that type where you're inventing the whole world, you do have to you don't need to actually sit down and explain how a bow and arrow works, but things that people won't understand, you have to take a moment and explain. And that's really one of the reasons why I actually got nailed for using cliched things such as elves and dwarves and using them in a traditional fashion. But the real reason I did that was because I didn't want to have to stop and explain it to you. If I made another race and gave them a different name, I'd have to go through the whole story of explaining all the background information. Whereas you get a lot of that already if you're using things that people are somewhat familiar with. So I didn't have to go to that level of explaining every little thing. I've read books where they completely change the world, so it's completely original, and I'm completely lost for the first half of the book. I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. So I was trying to avoid that because I had a very complex story I was trying to tell, and I didn't want to have that fighting with also having to explain every aspect within the world on top of it.
Yeah. And you mentioned kind of earlier that you, that you put these little hints of things that might become important, in the next book or the book that follows. Did you have fun sort of, because there is a huge, like Jen was saying, it's very complicated political structure in the book, in terms of, who is trying to do what, who's trying to get more power, who's trying to steal power from another, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Did you kind of have fun kind of putting little hints for what will become bigger conflicts, these little nuggets?
Well, what I actually did was, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but I wrote the entire series before the first one was published. So I was just like J. Michael Sikarsky did with Babylon 5. I actually went through and wrote the entire 6 books out. And as I did it, as I came up with ideas, I would go back and sprinkle things throughout the basis of the first books so that everything made sense. So hopefully when you get to the last book of this series, everything from the very beginning to the very end will make perfect sense to you. There won't be a situation where this came out of the blue or this person couldn't have done this because of that. Everything, or you'll sit there and say, well, geez, I never saw that coming. Every time you get to a Revelations, and there's a reason for there's a name for that, every time you get to that point, you should be sitting there saying, oh, wow, that's incredible. But you know what? I should have guessed that because of that and that. So it should be a situation where you should be able to have the tools to guess what's going to happen. But through my sleight of hand in misdirecting your attention, hopefully you won't figure it out before or too much before it happens. If I did my job right, what I would want to have happen is for the reader to speculate about what's going to happen, ponder over it, and then figure it out just sentences before I tell them. Because in that fashion, you get the sense of accomplishment of figuring it out and feeling good about yourself and feeling smart. But at the same time, it doesn't ruin the effect of the revelation that finally hits you. So I was trying to figure out how to do that. And it's really hard to do when you have an audience of variety of people. But for the most part, the reviews I'm getting seem that I did that pretty well for the most part.
Oh, I had a great time trying to figure things out.
Yeah,
and I have to admit I'm looking forward to the next one just to see if the answer is going to be in the next one or if I'm going to have to wait three more books, which might piss me off a little bit.
But. Well, no, here's the good thing, Jen. It's not like George R. R. Martin. You're not going to have to wait 6 years
before. I don't have to wait for it. Yay!
It's out.
That was one of the things I used to do when I was making signings at bookstores, and people would come up to me and they would say, you know, what is this? And I would tell them about the story, and I'd say, oh, by the way, you know, and they're all done. So even if I'm hit by a truck as I walk out of this store, you'll get the end of this story.
So one of the aspects of the kind of complicated political background that you set up in the story is the competition between the three political structures, imperialism, royalism, and nationalism. And I can't wait to see which one wins out in the end. But can you talk a little bit about how, you know, what compelled you to put this into a book that is essentially just, you know, kind of a episodic adventures between Hadrian and Royce? I mean, obviously there's a lot more going on, but the fact that you put that much politics in it is really fascinating. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, let's see, as a book, you have multiple layers of things that are happening and it just allows you to do more things with the plot and weave more, you know, elements on top of each other. As far as the three political parties is essentially, when you think about it, the empire, is sort of like, Imperial Rome. And this would be in the Middle Ages after it had fallen. So you have people who, are like Charlemagne, who wanted to be the Holy Roman Empire. So they're trying to recapture that original glory. And that's where, of course, the heir issue comes from. Then, of course, I realized that, you know, the people who already have power, the monarchies, they're not going to be willing to give up that in favor of being part of a cog and part of an empire. They're going to want to be able to retain their independence. So I figured that would just be a natural, you know, situation that would occur. And then I wanted another character because I had to have this character, and I wanted him to be a political character, but I wanted him to be in conflict with it too. So that's when I invented the nationalists, which is a group of a very modern thinking people, which wouldn't have happened, I don't think, in the Middle Ages. I tend to play with time things. There's sailing ships and there's people with powdered wigs, which never would have existed at that time either. But in this case, it's people who want to be essentially a democracy or at least an oligarchy or something where they want to be independent of kings and queens, and they want to start a grassroots revolution. And the main character there is the Gungan, and he's the one who's basically the leader of the nationalists. I just needed him to have a purpose. So that's what I invented for him. And as it turns out, after I invented it, of course, I began using it. So I ended up having these three evenly balanced political parties that were really utilizing either something I pulled out of history or were just, you know, plot-based or character-based supports. And after I had them, I just worked with them and they became more and more elaborate.
Fantastic. Okay, so I've got one silly question before we go to the sort of closing out questions. And it's just that dwarf question I promised you that was coming up. What do you have against dwarves? Because you're not very nice to your elves either, but at least they seem to get some dignity in terms of being oppressed. But your dwarves are just evil. They're so evil.
You haven't read the second book.
I know. I'm just thinking of Magnus and just... Oh, I hate that dwarf so much, but it's your fault because you made him so unlikable. So what's up with that?
I think I can speak for Jennifer here and tell you that you need to read more.
But he's so evil.
I hated him in the first book, too. And in fact, in the second one, I'm still not sure if I like him, but at least he's a little bit less unlikable.
Yeah, I think one thing I've always kind of liked in books that I've read before is when an author will introduce a character and make you really hate them. And then over time, you start to actually like that person. Then they become like your favorite character. And that sort of thing kind of compelled me in a number of different characters. So I wouldn't write off Magnus just yet. But there are many other characters in here that will flip-flop on you. And you'll realize that at one point you really don't like them. Another point, they're not so bad.
Well... Okay, but I'm with Royce for the time being.
You'll have to go on the journey with Royce. when you find out the reasons behind things, you'll understand that your opinion of what you thought was true isn't. And that's something you'll find a lot in my books, is that when you're certain you know something, that's just about the time that you're going to discover you're completely wrong.
But they're so clever. Like, I can't talk about the end of that, of the first half of Theft of Swords, which is the first book in the original publications, because if I did, I would ruin something. But gosh, he's so clever and evil clever.
Well, that was the point. We wanted to make sure you had that impression.
Yeah. And like I said, it's not that he becomes quite likable, and you don't necessarily forgive him, but he does become less unlikable.
Does it become likable in the way where, like, you like somebody because you don't like them?
No, not really.
Okay.
You just don't detest them as much. You go, eh, okay, fine, I kind of get it. At least in the second one, at least in Avanpartha. I don't know how nice he gets later on. I doubt he ever gets that nice. But...
Yeah, I'm sure you'll find that the book, the series, that there'll be a lot of surprises.
Yeah. Yes.
And I hope the elves get their due, because there's one half elf in the first book, and I feel really bad for him.
Yes, now I know who you're talking about. Of course, I
feel really bad for him, and I just wanted to give him a hug, but he's not real.
Yeah, I'm sure you won't. You won't have that opinion by the time you get done with the series, and of course you will get done with the series, right?
Yeah, of course. I've got. Pretty much every book, I think, now. So either in the original format or now the new one. So I got plenty.
Well, see, you're going to have to get me back for another talk when you guys get done with it. And just you're not going to be able to have it.
Just darn gush.
It's going to be spoilers, so you can't have anyone listen to it. But
it's one of the funnest parts about our job.
Yeah.
Is trying not to spoil things for other people.
It's tough. It's really tough. Because there's stuff I want to talk about with you, but I can't ask you. Because then I give details away that I don't want other people to know yet.
Earlier, you were talking about reviews, and I think I actually wrote a blog post on this like a year ago or more, where I was writing what I thought was a good review versus what's a bad review. And a good review is one that gives a reader information that they need to decide whether they think they would like the book without giving away spoilers. And I have had bad reviews of my book in the sense that they didn't like my book, but I thought they were great reviews because they were very articulate. They explained things really well, but they didn't give it away so that it would ruin it for someone else. And even though I disagreed with them, and even though they didn't like my novel, I still thought it was an excellent and very well done review. And those I have a great deal of respect for. But then when you have someone else who would trash it and not give anyone information that really helped them determine whether they want to get this book or not, and they give away spoilers, that's like the worst I can think of.
Makes sense.
Yeah, generally I don't like spoilers either. Yeah.
I sometimes go and read spoilers after I just drive myself crazy trying to figure something out, but that's because I'm a cheater.
You don't read the end of the book, do you?
I do not read I never read the end of the book. That's the interesting thing. I never will actually read the end of the book. But I've been watching Doctor Who recently, and there were some things that were driving me freaking insane, and I had to find out what happened. So I have to admit, I went and I cheated, and I looked a couple things up. But I try not to do that too often, because it does kind of ruin things for future discovery. But there's some things that you just can't wait for. For me, it was Rose. I couldn't wait to find out if Rose was coming back or not.
What?
For those who watch Doctor Who. Yes, I couldn't wait. I could not wait. It was driving me insane.
What?
I couldn't.
What is wrong with you? The whole series is on Netflix. You could have spent the whole night and watched it.
Well, and I still couldn't wait. I was sitting there watching it on Netflix, and I still couldn't wait. Michael, do you have any idea what we're referring to? Do you watch Doctor Who at all?
I've never seen an episode of Doctor Who, but I have heard many people talk about it.
It's fantastic. Well worth watching, but I had to know. There's just certain things in the world that you have to know.
No willpower. None whatsoever.
I have none.
I've lost all respect for you.
And I honestly, there's a certain spoiler in Michael's book that I think I might have to go look up because it might drive me insane.
I think you might have a problem with that.
I know, I do.
No. I mean, you won't be able to look it up. There are no.
Damn you!
You can't look it up. They're too new. There's nothing like on Wikipedia that has a synopsis of my books.
No! Oh, cruel world.
I'm evil that way.
Yes,
but I think I'm a hero. In my own mind.
Yes, and that's all that matters, really.
So we gotta kind of wind up, which sucks, but we can't go for 12 hours because A, some of us have school tomorrow, and B, I don't think anybody would listen to a 12-hour podcast. Although that would be... They might. Who knows? But
you could do it in episodes.
This is true.
And we could like have a series arc where we talk never mind.
For 12 episodes. We could have a whole month just spanned out just for...
And people would look up spoilers.
See, that's the problem. We'd give away spoilers.
That's right.
See?
But who would listen to this whole thing to find the one spoiler?
Oh, we've got a few dedicated listeners who we think are idiots, but you know.
Hey.
They're out there. I'm kidding! We love you.
Be nice. Okay, so, well... You've just had the third and the orbit versions of the book come out last month, yes?
Yes, that would have been 31st of January.
Okay, so all three books are now out, which means everybody needs to go to their bookstore and get them. At the very least, get the first book, but if you can, get all three books, even if you have to sell like your pants or something to get them.
Or your firstborn, that's okay too.
No, let's not sell children, that's illegal.
Oh,
but
that's
you can.
I forgot about that.
I'm not saying you should go to prison, but, you know, but what can people expect from you in the near future? I mean, do you have any, say, convention appearances, or should we expect short stories, or is there a new book coming soon, or something of that nature?
Well, I've been working on at least two books in the interim. One, however, has nothing to do with the Royce and Hadrian world. It's a contemporary novel, fantasy. Which has it's not medieval, it's nothing like that. So it's more of a what if story. In fact, it's what if you had the power to do anything you wanted, you know, that is controlled only by your imagination or limited only by your imagination. So that's a completely different type of book. And depending on how well this series does, I have contemplated writing some prequels to the series because people wanted to know, like, Royce and Hadrian the early years. And that was really my wife who wants to know that. So she has put it up and said, you know, you could really do this. You could write more. And I'm like, really can't write any more after the end of the series because it ties up in such a way that I wouldn't attack any more on.
She is your wife. Can't she just ask you?
Well, it was funny because we were walking, I think, to have lunch one day. And she stopped and she looked at me and she says, wow. I said, what? She goes, I just realized something. I said, what do you mean? She says, you can make them come back alive anytime you want to.
It's so true. It's the nice thing about being the writer.
It was like being God, you know. It's like, and she goes, you've got to do that. And I'm like, you know, they're not in a box in my desk, you know, in pain or something that if I don't breathe life into them. But she's like, oh, yeah, you can make them come back anytime you want to. She says, that's really not fair. So she's kind of been trying to talk me into writing a few prequels. So instead of the Rhaera Revelations, there would be the Rhaera Chronicles, which talks about, you know, the earlier years of their adventures. So that's one thing I might end up doing.
And do you have any convention appearances coming up?
Nothing that I have planned. I have a talk that I'm doing at the Library of Congress on the 16th. And then I'll be I appear at a number of local book clubs who are all finishing the series. And so I will go in and talk those. And I might make an appearance at Balticon this year, which is the Baltimore Fantasy Convention, Fantasy and Science Fiction Convention. But I'm not planning on doing any speaking there. I just may go there to see other people. But no, at this point in time, I have no actual plans for appearances. No one wants to see me anyway. Come on.
That's awesome, though. You're going to be at the Library of Congress.
Yeah, they called me up and asked me, which was kind of neat. They're going to like have a parking spot and everything for me. I thought that was very cool. They may even take me out to lunch, so I have that.
Wow, that's iffy.
That's pretty awesome. I'm just saying, like that's almost Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, well, it's funny because just earlier today I found something. I don't know how we found it, but there's a best-selling list that's put out in the UK, and apparently I'm on their top 10 best-selling list, and I'm just ahead of James Patterson and Stephen King, which seems totally absurd because there's not even another fantasy author on the list. I'm like, okay, where's Martin? Where are these other people who should be on this list? But I mean, I'm like, this is bizarre. But for the top-selling books right now in ebook in the UK, I'm listed as one of the top 10. I'm like, okay, something's wrong.
That's awesome.
That is awesome, though. Yeah.
If it's true and not just some cruel hoax by a friend or something.
Yeah, I would be. I mean, I went to the site. And I'm like, well, geez, it looks like it's there. And I just don't understand. I figured there's got to be something I'm missing.
That's awesome.
Cool. So where can people find you? You know, websites, blogs, that sort of thing. Do you have a secret dungeon?
A secret dungeon, really? Do you have one?
Yes,
I
do.
We're working on it.
Where you keep Doctor Who. My web address is ryira.com, which, if you don't know how to spell, is R-I-Y-R-I-A. And that will take you to my website, which is also my blog. But if you look at the tabs along the top, you'll be able to see, you know, where I'll be, works in progress, contact information, all that kind of fun stuff, as well as my daily blog, which if you read that, it should be fairly entertaining as well. I try to keep my information not only informative, but somewhat entertaining. Awesome. In fact, it's kind of funny is that the Polish publisher who has translated my books into the Polish, they go to my website and they take excerpts from I've written a series of posts on writing, on how to, you know, for writing tips for other writers. And they've taken those and they've actually published them in magazines in Poland, which is I actually have bylines on the covers of magazines in Poland.
In Polish or is it?
Yeah, it's in Polish.
Whoa.
I can't read them.
Do they pay you for these things?
No, they consider it promotion. I mean, they're all free anyway. I mean, anybody can go on my website and take them. But so it's like, but I just found it fascinating that here, without even knowing it, I have these bylines on these full color magazines in Polish. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I don't even know which ones they're doing. I have to look through it and try to find common words. Like, oh, look, let's see there. That's Hemingway. Where did I ever mention Hemingway in a post?
That's awesome.
That's great. Well, it was really fantastic having you on the show, Michael. We really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah,
and I enjoyed being here. Thank you both.
Yeah, we'll definitely have you on again at probably at some point this year, since you've had the third book coming out. We should definitely get you on again, and once Jen and I have read the rest of the series and been through it, we should definitely have you on.
Yeah, that way you can yell at me or be applauding me or something, depending on how you take the ending.
I'm
looking
sure,
forward to it.
I'm sure we wouldn't bring you on just to yell at you. That'd be kind of...
Well, I might.
Well, Jen, she's a little mean.
I haven't been able to yell at an author yet. I'm looking forward to the
challenge. Oh, yeah. Well, we're very sensitive people, you know.
Jen, if you haven't noticed, she's a dwarf.
I'm not.
Okay, so if anybody wants to send us a message or hate mail that we can send anonymously to Michael, which has never happened, but we always leave the offer open in case somebody does. That way we can laugh when we don't actually forward it. But if anybody wants to do that, you can do it in one of four ways. You can go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
Twitter.
Twitter.com/SkiffyandFanty.
Blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
Oh, you got it this time.
I did. Oh. I did.
You may not know, Michael, but I intentionally mix those up to get Jen off guard.
Every single episode drives me crazy.
Cool. So it was great.
So who's the dwarf here?
Jen is.
Because you seem kind of evil yourself.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. That's fair. I do plan tricks. I am a little bit like Magnus. This is a problem.
It's okay. You're not entirely unlikable.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Cool. Thank you again for being on the show, Michael. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, and we'll see everybody else at some point whenever we have another episode, which is always the week after. So.
Yep. Yep. Toodles.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
Heart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you, always.
End of line.